Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is none other than Jane Cohen. She's a writer, dabbles in history, culinary Jewish history, as well as other cuisines. And above all, she's a superb cookbook writer. I have in my hands a book that she originally published in 2008, but has just come out in ebook form. The book is Jewish Holiday Cooking, A Food Lover's Treasury of Classics and Improvisations. Not only does it have wonderful recipes, but she has a lot of interesting variations that take the classics we all grew up with and bring them into the 21st century. In a way, it modernizes them, and yet it doesn't sacrifice anything of everything we loved as children. In the introduction to her book, she says, food is a metaphor for all that is delicious in life, for everything that we share with those we love. Good evening, Jane.
Good evening, Chaim. Great to be here.
Let me ask you to expand a little on that sentence from your introduction.
Okay. Well, I would say that in our family, our recipes are our stories. I mean, encoded in our special family recipes are the stories of our family celebrations that included some people who are no longer with us, and very, very special memories that we have of them. I can tell you a very poignant story about my dad. When he was very, very ill and no longer able to eat at all, what I fed him were recipes. He was no longer able to actually digest food, but what he wanted to hear were not the stories of what was going on in everybody's day-to-day life, but he wanted to hear how I made my mother's salmon croquettes, how I would make my grandmother's stuffed cabbage, his favorite chopped eggs and onions, and it was as if I were taking down the family stories, but what I realized was that our recipes were our family stories, and those recipes nourished him.
Well, let me ask you then to explain something about an article that of yours that appeared in Jewish Woman's Magazine.
Okay.
You have an article about Indian cooking. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How does that come into, family cooking? How does that show the history, the connection with the past, the connection with the very different traditions that Jews have in almost every country, especially those who are not Ashkenazic, how we differ, and yet to a certain degree, in spite of all the differences, how food makes us all the same?
Well, I think if you look at Jewish cuisine, whether you're looking at Indian Jewish cuisine, Cucina Ibraica, the Italian Jewish cuisine, Hungarian Jewish cuisine, essentially you're talking about a bubi cuisine, a grandmother cuisine, a cuisine that's very family-centered and infused with a real hominess. We're not talking about a cuisine with court traditions. We're talking about a cuisine that celebrates the family table. And I think that's true whether you're looking at far-flung places in the diaspora or, a simple Polish meal at home. And I strongly feel that one of the most important tasks that I had set for myself was to really challenge the idea of Jewish cuisine as a dreary and unrefined kind of marginalized ethnic cuisine, because it's a very exciting cuisine. It's if you look
you
at.
You mean there is more to Jewish cuisine than gefilte fish and brisket?
Well, I can tell you that when I first started out with my first book, which was called The Gefilte Variations, kind of a play on Box Goldberg variations, and I talked about what I wanted to do, make the food interesting not only to Jews but to non-Jews as well, treat it as a serious cuisine. The first thing that somebody said to me was, oh, gourmet Jewish food, that's when you don't burn the pot roast. I mean, I feel that for us as Jews, one of the most important things that we do with our food is create Jewish food memories for our children. Because you might think of Jewish food as a link to the past, but it's also our link to the future in creating food memories for our children. And while we're talking about this cuisine as a booby cuisine, it's still an evolving cuisine. We don't want it to be something static, because, frankly, unless you continue to update the recipes and create new food traditions and food that's exciting for today's palate, what's going to happen to a grandmother cuisine? It's going to die out when the grandmothers die.
As a matter of fact, you mentioned something about that in your introduction.
Yes.
Your introduction, you talk about the fact that the first Passover without your grandmother, you shared a secret, and I quote, "You shared a secret suspicion that allowing her foods to vanish from our table meant losing something much greater and more vital, and we could not bear another loss."
Yes, this was a really very hard thing for us to deal with when my grandmother passed away, because food was such an essential part of our family lives. I mean, I come from a real foodie family. Everybody in the house cooked. Not only my mother, my sister, and I, but my father and my brother as well. For us, what was exciting when I was growing up were the kinds of flights of fancy that my mother would indulge in with her big Italian meals. We never considered Jewish food exciting. It was what we had for our holidays, and that was the food that my grandmother cooked. I mean, my mother would occasionally, you know, she'd make brisket and a chicken soup, but for anything extensive for the holidays, we really relied on my grandmother, and we never thought, you know, the day would come that we would not know how to recreate her cuisine. So what that first Passover without her, aside from missing her so terribly at the table, we also missed that cuisine. So we set about trying to not replicate the kind of food that she used to make, but replicate it according to our palates of that day, you know, the things that we found exciting in food. I was the one who always used to steal my grandmother's matzo balls. She always called me Ganef because I would eat them instead of cookies. So when I was making her matzo balls that Passover, I added in things that I add in to maybe gnocchi or something like that, chopped herbs and some sautéed garlic. And that really started us on a real appreciation of how wonderful and exciting Jewish food could be. I mean, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, which was really a time of assimilation when I think people's ideas of Jewish food, with the exception of maybe matzo balls and bagels and a few other foods, you know, it was not something that was considered appealing to the general public. Gefilte fish, you had to be Jewish to appreciate gefilte fish. Today, you see gefilte fish being made in non-Jewish restaurants, Tony fashionable non-Jewish restaurants. It's not the same gefilte fish that I grew up with, but it is gefilte fish. Wolfgang Puck makes gefilte fish that's scented with tarragon. People make exciting kinds of gefilte fish at restaurant seders. Rosa Mexicano makes one with a Mexican salsa. So I think it's not just me, but I think that people are, many chefs as well, are coming to realize that Jewish food is a really exciting cuisine, and something that is not just a private kind of marginalized cuisine that could only be appreciated by Jews.
I read in another cookbook by another author that Jewish cuisine is not exactly Jewish cuisine, but it's a cuisine of the world adapted to the needs, to the cultural and religious needs of the Jews. And as you look around to the different lands of the diaspora, as you look at Italy, as you look at Germany, Poland or Hungary, or you look at the Middle East, you realize that after Jews came to whatever the country, they just adapted the local cuisine rather than bring some of their own, for the simple reason that a lot of the ingredients were not available, or there were ingredients that could be used instead and would make the traditional dish that much better. And I noticed that throughout your book. For example, brisket. I mean, what could be more Jewish than a nice brisket on a yontef? And yet you have variations like eggplant-stuffed brisket braised with tomatoes, saffron, and honey. That is not how my grandmother used to make it.
but brisket is a traditional Jewish cut of meat for a multitude of reasons, starting with the fact that Jews were so limited in the kinds of cuts that they could use.
Right.
And brisket was something that, cooked properly, can be very, very tender once the collagen is released slowly into the gravy. But I have a lot of fun with brisket. I guess my most popular brisket dish is my brisket with 36 cloves of garlic, which is a play on the French roast chicken with 40 cloves of garlic. And what I do with the, you know, 36, of course, it being twice chai. So what I do with the garlic is I cook it very slowly in the brisket and then puree it, and that becomes the gravy. So there's no starch in the gravy at all. And then I put a top note of flavors, because you notice that with not only with chulent and dafina, chamins, and so on, that mm-hmm. so much of Jewish food is very slow cooked. And while it can be very tender and flavorful, it often lacks that zing at the end. So what I do to the brisket with the 36 cloves of garlic is I add something similar to an Italian gremolata, which is a grated lemon peel, chopped rosemary, and a little bit of fresh chopped garlic, and I stir that in at the very end, and that adds a bright top note to finish it off, so it makes the gravy come alive. But what you said about there being no real Jewish cuisine, I don't know. There are many characteristics that I think Jewish cuisine throughout the diaspora have in common. Aside from the kinds of meats that they use, there's also that that taste for sautéed onions, slow-cooked onions, which I've noticed in Indian cuisine and in Polish cuisine, in Moroccan Jewish cuisine. There's also a taste for sweet and sour that runs throughout the diaspora. Different. The sweet and sour kinds of foods are different throughout the diaspora, but it's there. You can see it in Iraqi fish dishes. You could see it in Persian dishes, in fish dishes from Italy, obviously the Polish dishes, and so on. And I think that speaks to the metaphor of Jewish existence, that even in the moment of pure joy, you also remember the sorrowful. The breaking of the glass during the wedding, the spilling of the wine during the Seder so that you're not drinking a full cup. Even the Hillel sandwich, which I think is the perfect food metaphor of sweet and sour. So, and I think many of the dishes Jews adapted so that they would suit ritual needs. But then again, you see all Jews have something for Hanukkah, which would reflect the miracle of the oil. That is something that is fried in oil. It might be bimuelos, those fritters, Sephardi fritters, or it might be potato latkes. But, you have these commonalities throughout the diaspora.
Talking about latkes, which you just mentioned, and considering that Hanukkah is almost upon us in just a couple of weeks, we published earlier this week, we published one of your recipes for latkes. Again, a very unusual recipe, garlic, rosemary, potato latkes. I can just smell the aroma as it fills the kitchen. And yes, I grew up liking the normal aroma of the standard potato latkes. But garlic, rosemary, sounds incredible. I can tell you how to make it.
Yes. They are delicious. And one thing about the garlic rosemary latkes is they really don't need any adornment. You could just put a little fine sea salt on to serve it. You don't need any applesauce or sour cream or anything. They're perfect as is. And because you don't need sour cream, they're great as an accompaniment to any kind of meat dish. They are one of my favorites. But I have to say that I make all kinds of latkes during Hanukkah. And one that I've really come to like a lot, I think your background is also Polish, right?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I don't know if you ever had sugar on your latkes.
Yes, occasionally, not too often.
I have no
sweet
dishes.
Especially when we went to some of our relatives who are much more into sweets than my parents.
I actually have no sweet tooth. I don't enjoy desserts. But my grandmother used to make very oniony latkes, which I make with shallots so that you could get even more of that onion flavor into it, and with just a tiny little light dusting of sugar. And even though I don't like sweet things, the combination of that shallots, the sautéed shallots, and just a little tiny bit of a dusting of granulated sugar, not powdered sugar, because you don't want it to sort of coat it. That's one of my favorites, and definitely a very, very evocative memory of my grandmother.
Go ahead.
But there are so many things that you can make latkes out of. When I was in Paris at one of the food markets, the organic food market, they made something, they called it galette al oignon, a pomme de terre, but really what it was half onion, half potato, made into a latke, very delicious. But instead of using flour to bind it, what they used was a little bit of grated cheese. And I've made that, and that's also a delicious way of serving latkes.
One of the things that I like a lot about your cookbook is it's peppered with all types of quotations from Yiddish writers, all types of quotations, not just from current writers, although your favorite, who also happens to be my favorite, seems to be Chaim Grabe.
Yes, yes.
You quote him a lot. You also bring things from the Talmud, you bring things from the Zohar, from Shmuel HaNagid, and other such. Obviously, you also have a love of literature.
Yes.
So how is it that even though you were not trained as a chef, that you started writing and liked especially food writing, and then from there you went to write a book? And I must add, it's fast becoming one of my favorite cookbooks in my whole collection. I love reading it because of the way you introduce each dish. You bring it alive. And you do so in, like I said in my review this past Monday, in the tradition of some of the greatest food writers. How did you transition from writing about food to actually doing a cookbook?
Oh, well, thank you for saying that, Chaim. Well, I always wrote. I started off as a writer, whether it was doing PR work or technical writing or whatever, and then just began writing about actually the history of food. My first article was an American history article on ketchup. And I am still very interested in food history. I have an article coming out on the origin of Goodman's matzahs during the Civil War period for a history journal, food history journal. But I was a voracious reader when I was in college and couldn't afford to go out for very good meals or buy expensive ingredients. What I would do is I would take tons of different cookbooks out of the library, and I would vicariously experience the taste of these wonderful recipes, and at the same time devour some of the best food writing ever written by M.F.K. Fisher, Liebling, and so on. And it was certainly a lot better for my waistline. It's actually a great way to appreciate food. But in that way, I was also able to imagine different flavor combinations and train my palate. And even now, there are many things that I can sort of taste in my mind's eye by reading about them. One example of that was when I had been doing research on the Jews of France who had been expelled at the end of the 14th century, and they had been allowed to remain in four small communities in Provence, and among them was the little town of Carpentras. And there was a Jewish writer, Armand Lunel, who wrote beautifully about these Jews. One of his books was Jerusalem à Carpentras. That was Jerusalem in the little town of Carpentras. And he described a dish that sounded so delicious to me, and I was unable to find any traces of recipes from the community. I think it has been absorbed by Ashkenazi and North African Jews, because there is still a community and a little synagogue in Carpentras. So when I read about this dish, which was a dish of breast of veal that he talked about as being meltingly tender and stuffed with spinach and chard and rice and all kinds of herbs. I wound up devising my own recipe for it because it had stuck in my brain so and made me hunger for the dish so much that I kept experimenting until I came up with a version that I really enjoyed.
Now, you talk about food as a link to the past and a link to the future. You talk about food as something that brings back sweet memories, something that brings back laughter, something that sometimes reminds us of past tears.
Right.
I am sure, however, that in your journey as a cook, as your family was growing up, as you were growing up, no matter the bittersweet memories, there also must have been something that, as you look back, may not have seemed funny at the time, but in retrospective, it is absolutely hilarious. Could you tell us an anecdote or two about such things?
Well, I alluded to this before, but when my grandmother would be making her matzo balls, her knedlach, which were golf ball size, and I can tell you that they were the hard kind, but I loved them. Every year, as I would be the one who would be making up the Seder plate, she would have a bowl of the cold matzo balls waiting to be put into the soup, and she would half not look and half look as I would steal them from her, and that was when she
so
would always call me Donna.
And then
later on, when I was doing research for my book, I found that there was a kind of matzo ball or matzo ball like dumpling that's actually put on top of a chulent, and it's called a ganef because it steals the flavors from
right.
the chulent. So so it just reminded me of my grandmother. And
so you mean to tell me that when you were in charge of distributing the knedlach, not too many of them actually made it to the table then?
Absolutely, that's definitely true. And I was never the one to eat any of the desserts. But after everybody finished, I would go into the refrigerator and have another cold matzo ball.
I am looking at some of the titles of your articles. And one that immediately caught my attention was the one on the Indian High Holiday Cuisine, a whiff of cardamom, a dash of curry. There is something about that title that immediately brings to mind certain aromas, certain flavors. And I look at some of your other articles, like, for example, the one on Hungary where chont is chic. It's obvious by your choice of titles that you enjoy what you're writing about. It is obvious that you're going to be telling a good story besides whatever the recipe that you bring in as an example is. What is, when you write an article, what is the most important thing to you, the actual recipe or the story around the recipe?
Actually, the story around the recipe, definitely the story around the recipe. I love to travel, and I find that the easiest way to talk to people where I'm traveling is to talk to them about food, because nothing is going to elicit more intimate talk, more personal talk than talking about a food memory. And one of the things I found fascinating about Hungary is that Cholent is served in many non-Jewish restaurants, as is matzo ball soup, and cholent can very often be, can have pork in it, and other non-kosher ingredients. It's part of the culture, and you can go into a restaurant where there are all kinds of pork products on the menu, but then there'll be a goose soup with matzo balls. It's this strange kind of development, because at one time before the war, so much of Hungary, so much of Budapest was Jewish, and many people, whether through intermarriage or through servants who learned how to cook the Jewish food in Jewish homes, so many people developed a taste for Jewish food. So you find that there's matzah meal and matzah available in neighborhoods with very few Jews, and you find these treif cholents on the menu. It's a fascinating story. It's one way, also through food, of actually discovering so much about the culture. Another story that I worked on very recently for this autumn was on the cuisine of the Bukharian Jews. And again, through food, and the people were so welcoming, the people whom I had interviewed about the cuisine, but you learn so much about them through the kinds of food that they eat. And incidentally, that was a place that Chaim Grad had spent a good deal of time in that whole area, because which he wrote about in My Mother's Sabbath Days, because that was the area that he escaped to during World War II. And he described in such beautifully poetic words the market, the fruit market in Tashkent, and the kind of communion he had with a little Bukharian fruit seller who pressed an old pomegranate in his hands so that he would have something to say the Shecheche Yonu on at Rosh Hashanah. Beautiful food writing, very evocative.
It's very interesting what you said about non-kosher, or even non-Jewish restaurants integrating Jewish food.
Closer to home, where I live in the village, in Greenwich Village, and a few years ago there was a restaurant called Merge, and on the menu they had a sweet potato tzimis, and do you know what it was the accompaniment for? A pork chop.
Yeah. What I found interesting, and this complements your story. It's a great accompaniment to your story. A mutual acquaintance of yours and mine, Chef Walter Potenza.
Yes.
Whom I had on this program before. On his restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island, Potenza Ristorante, the flagship of his restaurant empire, he does serve quite a bit of Jewish food. In fact, when I was there in Providence, I did a short video of him preparing a Jewish recipe, which he assures me is one of the most popular ones in his restaurant. And let's face it, he doesn't get Jewish customers in his restaurant. He just gets Italians who know what a good dish is.
Right.
And this particular one consisted of a variation on the Hillel sandwich. He had matzah. He had lettuce. He had a little bit of horseradish. And then he tempered that, the heat of the horseradish, with some raisins and some other fruits. Unfortunately, it wasn't kosher. I couldn't taste it. But as he was cooking the whole thing, the aromas going through the kitchen were incredible.
Mm.
And he said that was a traditional Jewish recipe from Padua.
Mm.
And
quite a few
such.
Was the matzah cooked?
The matzah was not cooked.
Right.
He cooked everything, and then he put a bit of matzah on the bottom and a bit of matzah on top.
Mm. And again, you have that sort of that sweet and sour.
Absolutely.
Together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, time is running out. There is so much I wanted to talk to you. So many subjects I didn't get a chance to touch on. I'm going to have to ask you to come back and be a guest on our show again, please.
Oh, that would be my pleasure, Chaim. I would love to do that.
Okay, and thank you very much, Jane. Reading your book, even if I do not at the moment make the recipe, is an absolute pleasure.
Well, you could do what
I love
did
the way you write.
Just read the recipes and get the satisfaction out of that for a while until you're ready to cook them.
Absolutely.
That's what I always do.
That's what I've been doing. You started me on a new habit. Okay. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Please tune us in next week when our guest will be Susie Fishbein, also next Wednesday at 10 o'clock. Thank you and good night, one and all.